Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves, and we are joined today by the wonderful Patty Strand from National Animal Interest Alliance. And Patty's got some really exciting news, I think, that she'll share with us later in the podcast, and also some great advice. So, Patty, welcome.
Thank you. I'm just kind of bathing in my wonderfulness here. Thank you for the introduction.
Everybody needs a little wonderful in their life.
The most wonderful introduction I've ever had.
Everybody needs a little wonderful in their life, Patty.
Right. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about, but we're talking an elevator speech. So when we talk about we've encountered someone in our daily life and they have espouse to us an opinion that purebred dogs are what have you. They're obsolete, they're inherently bad, whatever. And so I'd like you to give us some ideas about how we as members of the purebred dog fancy, simply owners of purebred dogs, can offer up some ideas to those folks to help them see a different side to the issue.
Yeah, well, those folks are definitely out there. My son has an unneutered poodle. And he literally gets chased down the streets of Portland, Oregon. He takes his dog to work, and there are people who follow him on the street and tap him on the shoulder to make sure he understands what a crime he's committing by not neutering his dog. Does he understand the perils of dog overpopulation and all the things that go along with that? So we definitely do meet those people who are very concerned about different aspects of what they associate with purebred dogs. But an elevator speech is not just for those people who are already negative about purebred dogs. It's really an elevator speech is a commercial about the individual who carries it or about a cause that they have. And it's just something I tend to think that dog breeders should understand at this point in time that they are ambassadors for what they do all the time, whether they choose to be or not. They're the public relations face of the sport of dogs and of purebred breeding. So having something ready to say, just an elevator speech is very, very short. The elements of it are, number one, that it is short. It's about the time it takes to ride up in an elevator with somebody, which is 30 seconds or maybe a little bit more than that. And in terms of creating an elevator speech, it's just a very few sentences. I know I looked up on the internet what other people were saying about this, and the common number of sentences that they say it is 8 or 9 sentences. And I would say sometimes you don't even get that much time. So the issue with having an elevator speech, the reason that people need one, is because every chance you get to be an ambassador for your sport or your breed is one that you should be prepared to take advantage of. And the big thing now, again, if somebody does impugn purebred dogs or say something that you disagree with, that's certainly the opener to the conversation. But a lot of times you're in a line at a grocery store and nothing really negative has come up and you want the opportunity to be able to talk about purebred dogs, so you need an icebreaker. An icebreaker is just something that might make somebody else ask a question or proffer an idea in your direction. And so we have a group called Homes for Animal Heroes is one of our programs. It's a program that rehomes research dogs. And, of course, people who are engaged in doing life-saving research are constantly impugned by the ideologues and the animal rights movement, too. And so just one of the little things that we do is we have leashes inscribed for all of the dogs that are rehomed that say, "Ask me why I'm a hero."
Nice.
And it opens up the conversation to talk about the particular study that the dog was in, and people can see that the dog is happy and jumping around and like any other normal pet. And it gives the person holding the leash the opportunity to talk about research and how this little dog became a hero. But we don't always have the opportunity to have a dog on a leash and have a message pre-written on the leash. You can get stickers made up that say, "Ask me why I'm a dog lover," or "Ask me why I'm concerned about..." name your breed Great Danes or whatever, people may immediately assume that it's because a Great Dane ate your grandkid or something like that. I mean, with the negativity that's out there. But just something that's provocative enough to get people to ask. And I've seen bracelets, I've seen leashes, I've seen scarves. There are a lot of different kinds of attire that you can get or inscriptions that you can have made on t-shirts, sweatshirts that encourage conversation. So the key is to try to get the conversation to start, and then within that to understand that you're, whether you want to be or not, you are an ambassador for your breed. Body language is really important in any kind of communication. It's always about 90% how people feel about you, your countenance, whether you're smiling, whether you're frowning, whether you look like you're mad as a hornet, or all those different things add to the message. In fact, they are the message to a really right. big degree, whether people like you or not, for starters. So I would say with that, then you have to begin thinking about what kind of message you want to deliver. And I would say the most important thing for anyone in any of our audiences to understand is how much you love dogs. And for each person, there may be a number of different specific realities in your life that demonstrate that to you, just the amount of work you put in for your dogs, that you put your vet's kids through college, and now you're putting their grandkids through college, that you are somebody who takes care of their dogs, you train dogs one night a week, you belong to a kennel club that's been in your state for more than 50 years and supplies all the education or funds for spay-neuter, just anything that you can do that immediately conveys positive things about you and your love, your motivation for being involved with dogs, which is love. And I say that because one of the things that was troubling to me when I first started working in this area were, you know, listening to the public's ideas about what they thought of dog shows. You know, right. people running around the ring in fancy dresses and they don't really care about their dogs. There have been a lot of negative messages out there over the last 30 years about dog breeders. And so you have to recognize they're out there, and you immediately have to get your audience, your listener, to understand that you are devoted to your dogs. And again, I think everybody in our community is, and you can definitely prove that just quickly by going over how much money you spend every month on your dogs, how much care you put into them, how many hours a day you spend with them, the fact that you belong to clubs and other associations too. Make sure that you're not only an expert yourself, but sharing that information, whatever information you have, with the public so that they can enjoy their dogs more too. And then you have to convey what your concerns are. I mean, in my case, I work on legislation all the time. Unfortunately, often there is a current piece of legislation, a bill that's ongoing in my state or at the federal level that allows me to talk about it. More specifically, in recent times, I basically talk about the challenges to purebred dogs. After I've established that my concern, my love for dogs, I begin to state some of the concerns I have. And the big concern right now is how we're going to preserve our breeds. And there are so many challenges coming at us, whether it's, you know, legislation that's been proposed by ideologues that don't really believe that people should have a purebred dog or have any dog except maybe one that they just brought over from Korea. I mean, that's legitimate. I think when people understand that the marketplace is being transformed, and transformed as a result of a lot of different factors, but basically that folks that do not have the subject matter knowledge that we have are sort of in charge of the message today, and anybody who's in charge of the message winds up being in charge of the legislation that's passed as well, and that at this point in time, one of the biggest challenges we face is the importation of dogs from other countries where the veterinary care is not anywhere close to what it is in the United States, and the introduction of not only zoonotic diseases that, you know, can affect people too, but terrible infectious diseases that can really harm our dogs, the Korean flu that's coming in right now. I have not met one person who, when you give them the facts about what's going on, is not horrified. Doesn't matter what their party affiliation is. It doesn't matter where they start on the philosophical spectrum. Once they understand what the net results of this importing is doing, they immediately become engaged and side, actually, with us. So getting all that information out, I mean, in our case, I mean, I worry constantly about the displacement of well-bred dogs in the marketplace by dogs of poor quality. Dogs that, and of course, how you talk about this is very important, because you can simply sound like you're mean and you don't believe in mixed-breed dogs or mutts or any of that. You're just an elitist. So obviously you have to be very careful that you don't sound like you're one of those people. I don't think any of us are. We all work with all dogs. But the fact is, some of our breeds are absolutely challenged by the multitude of things coming at them. Legislation written by ideologues that don't believe in dog ownership or breeding, and just being inundated by the dogs that are coming in from all other sources, and most of them ones where the dogs are not well suited for family homes, whether it's because of infectious diseases or because of temperament issues. I just did an article in the Virginian. I don't know if you saw that.
I did, actually. And I thought that was very good.
That one speaks mostly to another really important developing issue, which is as this marketplace is being changed, it is not being changed for the better. The way that it's discussed, it is framed in such a way that the average person, unless they have had a personal experience, is going to think that it's all wonderful and light, that more dogs' lives are being saved. But a lot of the dogs' lives that are being saved today are dogs with known bite histories and serious health problems. You get to a certain point in trying to raise what's called the live release rate within a particular shelter, and you hit a certain point where you begin to place dogs that really shouldn't be placed in homes. So anyway, I make sure that I have a lot of different talking points about those things. They're kind of all in my head, quite frankly, because I've worked in this area for so long.
I think that that's important for so many of us, though, Patty, and that's why I wanted to hear from you so that we can give our listeners some ideas. And I think, too, that the important piece that I encounter is that when we're able to make the information that we're sharing with these folks be applicable to them. In other words, I don't want you to not be able to find a purebred dog, or I don't want your dog to be gotten sick because these other dogs came with poor health histories. And I think that when we're able to talk to people in that way and help them understand in a personal way, that it really moves our position into a more understandable realm.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Personalizing your message is critically important. And what's kind of interesting, what kind of comes up for me when you say that, it's so true, is that in the framing of the issues by what I'll just call the bad guys, people who are trying to change public opinion in a way that we view as harmful to dogs and to the maintenance of our breeds and so on, they absolutely personalize everything. And the way that they do it is pretty much by disparaging anybody who disagrees with them. Instead of having an argument about policy, it's always an argument about the worth, the actual human value of somebody who disagrees with them. So personalizing it, but in a positive way, as you suggest, is a huge key to all of this. And then finally, I want to say that, you know, there has to be sort of a point to this discussion, too. You need always to be able to give somebody a link to more information. You have to have some kind of call
action.
To action.
Yes.
Yeah. So again, if there's a piece of legislation underway in your state, that's a real easy vehicle, something to talk about and to give them an email address or a link to more information. But you want them to do something as a result of having this exchange with you. And so, for instance, we're going to be working on a national campaign with a federal bill in the coming months. Going to be a bill that will work to rein in the irresponsible importation of dogs from foreign countries with various diseases. And definitely it's something that will be done to protect our dogs on a lot of different levels. But there will be a campaign. There will be a central place to send people with the call to action so that they can become involved. You have to give people that opportunity to become involved with everything that you do.
So. Right. Absolutely.
That's pretty much it, I think, on the nature of an elevator speech is that it's intensely personal. I can't write the particular message for anyone besides myself. But if people will just sit down with a pen and paper and write down the things that are important to them, write down how they see themselves and what the assets are in their community. For instance, I used to just get so frustrated when the American Kennel Club was attacked by various outside groups because I knew that the AKC was the only organization that was actually putting money into improving kennels, putting millions of dollars into AKC canine health research, putting more millions of dollars into public education. putting on more than 5,000 events. And these events are, not only are they fun, wonderful sports, wonderful place to form lifetime relationships and all the great things that we do there, but they're also wonderful ways for people to bond with their dogs. And I could, honest to Pete, I could come up with a list of 100 different positive values that are associated with the AKC. And it's possible for individuals to do this, too, about what they do and what their relationships are in their community, whether they're training dogs one night a week, and if so, as volunteers, whether they belong to a kennel club that puts on events for the public, whether they belong, donate to spay-neuter funds for low-income people. There are just scores of different things that we're all involved in that are positive every day. In fact, the thing that's really unique about our community, truly unique, I can't think of another entity that operates this way, is that every one of us is a volunteer. People don't realize that. In today's world, almost everything everybody does has a price tag connected to it. Our price tag is just our commitment to our dogs. We love our dogs so much that we are willing to put in hundreds of hours a year. I work on Rose City Classic, and I can't tell you how many people put in so many hours to just make this event happen. And we have special rates for senior citizens and things we do for the 4-H'ers to make sure that they have access to these kinds of events at low cost or no cost. But all of our kennel clubs are doing these things. If, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, where your kennel club is or how big it is serving a particular need in its community, and yet we don't talk about it because since it isn't a business, we don't think about the need for public relations, and that is sorely missing in our world. You know, every humane society, no matter how small, has an office that puts out press releases with regularity. We don't do that. We need to do that regularly, every single club.
I think that's a hugely important piece of it, and I think one of the things I was just thinking about while we were talking about the elevator speech. Wouldn't it be a wonderful evening at the kennel club, one of your kennel club meetings, if everybody got together and did some role playing and practiced their elevator speeches and somebody play devil's advocate and say, how can you have this purebred dog? You're stealing. And somebody else comes and does their actual elevator speech. And I just was thinking that would be a wonderful program for our kennel clubs. Everybody, a very tactile activity, call to action for everybody listening, go out to your kennel clubs and have a practice session on your elevator speech.
Yeah, I like that idea. That's a good one. I think some people might get up and run out of the room when it got to be their turn. I used to be that bashful, believe it or not. It used to be so hard for me to say anything in public, but I've overcome it.
Yes, I certainly have overcome it well. But I think too, Patty, we have to, all of us involved in the sport, and this is what I've come to, you know, working with Pure Dog Talk and all the years in the sport, I think that your organization is so powerful because you give people a way to talk about things. I mean, they'll talk to anybody about their dog, but they don't want to talk about the hard stuff. And this enables people to have a real tangible asset to talk about.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Well, and we all do have stories. I mean, I live in the dog community, right? I talk to dog people every day, and I know which ones had to go to Dove Lewis at 2:00 in the morning for the C-section. And every single person that we work with has a story that demonstrates their commitment. It's just a fact. I don't know each story, but if people would just sit down and start jotting down the specific things that they do, why they do them, what motivates them to do them, it's all going to come back to love. It really will.
Right. Absolutely. Okay, so now I do want to talk whatever amount of detail we're allowed to about this bill that you were talking about earlier, because I think that is very exciting for this community to be taking positive action instead of being reactive to the other legislation that's being proposed by people who oppose the way we live our lives, that we're taking positive action on our own behalf through NAIA. I would love to hear more about that.
Yeah. Well, you should come to the conference. We're going to have October 2nd through the 4th in Washington, D.C. We're going to be introducing the legislation there. And by the way, I know AKC has legislation that they're going to be working on, too, regarding the TSA dogs and some dog breeding in the United States for detection work is desperately needed in this age of terrorism.
And that's one of the topics at the conference, right?
They're going to be speaking at the conference, too. Yeah, it should be really interesting. Homeland Security should be there. But, yeah, I cannot think of a single animal welfare issue that is more important, more pressing right now than the issue of unregulated dog trafficking, basically. If you're in favor of it, you call a humane location. If you've seen the negative side of it, you have to recognize that without oversight, it is just simply dog trafficking. And I think most of the people who are in the dog world who go to dog shows are aware of the flu that has come in recently from the Korean dogs, from the Asian dogs. But there are many other diseases and parasites that are also coming in and coming in regularly. I mean, just routinely, the sheer number of dogs that are coming into the United States, which, by the way, there's no agency that even keeps track of it. That's how difficult this particular issue is how little oversight it's had to this point. There are many agencies that have some interface with the issue, but the biggest problem all of us have had who've worked on it is that there is no one agency that can take charge of it. Zoonotic diseases is over at the Center for Disease Control. They don't have the personnel that USDA has. USDA has personnel, but their larger issues have to do with animal welfare through APHIS, and of course veterinary services might be very useful here. But the bottom line is that we have laws on the books today that are outdated. They were created for a different era in our history, and they are largely created for people who are traveling with their own dogs. They're not created. Nobody anticipated that rescue dogs from the street of third world countries would become, or that anybody would be able to market them in such a way that they would be popular and become a big marketplace consumer item. They've commodified the dogs that are in the streets of Asia. They have given people the idea that by importing one of these dogs and saving this particular life, that in the grand scheme of things, it's going to have an effect that is net positive. In fact, we know from what we're seeing that it has little effect, if any, at the source. It isn't like behavior is being changed at the source. It's creating a pipeline for sellers in the United States who call themselves rescuers to make a lot of money on dogs that are, in many cases, feral. They have not been socialized to people. If they're coming from really poor countries, they come in carrying diseases that none of us have ever even heard of, and different kinds of parasites and different kinds of ticks. All you really have to do to look at how serious this issue is there are many examples of, you know, if you bring in a dog or two or five or 10 and there are problems with him, it is not likely that you're going to negatively affect or introduce an epidemic into an area. When you start bringing in thousands of dogs that are not screened for all these different things that are available, that are, you know, diseases in the country they come from, you're really setting up a ticking time bomb kind of a scenario. And that's what's been going on for a long time in this country. It's a challenge because, you know, as we mentioned earlier, there are no solid numbers. The last numbers that were put out by any federal agency were in 2008, and at that time they were talking about a study they did that was a sting operation, and they extrapolated certain numbers from that. At that time, they said there were 300,000 dogs coming into the United States each year. 199,000 of those, and there is an article from the CDC on our website in the library white pages section.
Great.
That talks about this. At that time, they said that there were 199,000 dogs coming across the Mexican border. But at that time, the rest of Asia wasn't engaged in this. We weren't getting a lot of dogs from the Middle East. There was a trickle from all these places. And now we know, if you just read your newspaper headlines, there'll be 150 dogs from Korea going to this city in Florida, and then another 50 going to another city, and 200 going to Montana or Idaho. I mean, it goes on and on. And you just, basically, what we have done is we have kept all these records because, in fact, in raising funds for these dogs, the fundraisers tell you what they're getting from different places and what they're delivering to different parts of the country. So you'll see that a load of dogs from Korea went to Florida, and then the next thing you know, there are alerts in Florida about the Asian flu. And a lot of people are not so worried about the Asian flu, a lot of people in the general public, because one of the statistics that's given is that very few dogs die. And that's true. However, many, many, many dogs cost their owners thousands of dollars to get well at veterinarians. And recently in an article out of Montana, they were talking about over 150 dogs being sick and three dying. So it is obviously a very, very serious disease. And one thing I want to be real careful to mention, when we're talking about the importation of these dogs and the particular kinds of rescues that do this, I want to distinguish them from the rescues that work with parent clubs, the rescues that are working responsibly. And I also want to share something that might be a little bit surprising, and that is that we routinely get letters, calls, we're in contact with rescues that likewise want to see rescues in general just cleaned up. Ironically, they're in kind of the same situation we were in the early 90s, where all the legislation out there and all the discussion was about bad dog breeders. So no matter what you were doing as an individual, you were sort of painted with the same brush. And I want to be really careful not to do that. I am focused on a very specific kind of rescue that's going on that we believe is irresponsible. And it goes on within the United States, too. These are the dogs that I'm talking about in particular, and the dogs that we are going to first have a federal bill to deal with are those unowned dogs from foreign countries. We're not talking about limiting the ability of an individual to bring a pet to their house or breeders to import dogs of their breed. But what we are going to be promoting is the idea that the United States should not become the place to send the world's street dogs. And if you go back and you read, there's some really interesting articles in the New York Times. I think I might have mentioned this to you last time we spoke. But it's really fascinating to go back and read articles about the roundups that were occurring in New York City in the 1880s and 1890s and, you know, right up until the rabies vaccine was perfected and they were able to figure out how to deal with it. But those same conversations are being had now in countries like India and China and places that we're taking dogs in. I mean, we're literally that far ahead. And there are diseases, there are ticks that literally can kill people. So it's not a little issue, and there's just simply no reason to flood the marketplace in the United States with dogs that consumers, if they were aware of all the issues, would absolutely reject. So that's what we're going to be working on in the coming year. We believe it'll probably take about a year to get our legislation passed, but we're going to be calling on every single person in the dog fancy to help us. It's in the best interest of them and the best interest of public health in the United States.
Right.
So that's where we're going with this.
I think that's very, very exciting. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. And you're working hard on your conference for this fall, and we'll provide links to people if anybody's interested in attending that in Washington, D.C. That sounds
good.
Like,
let me throw something out here. Washington, D.C. has to be the most expensive place on the planet to hold a conference. And when you look at the sign-up fees and you look at the hotel, you're going to gasp a little bit. I want everybody to know that we are arranging roommates for people so that, you know, at least you'll be able to split the hotel fees. And then any club that is a part of NAIA, their members can have a discounted rate to get into the event, too.
Excellent. So, well, I think that's a lot of good work going on right now, and I just really want people to be able to know it's out there and know where to go to get more information.
We also have a new platform for just putting out the good word. Let's say that there's a breakthrough that the AKC Canine Health Foundation achieves.
Nice.
Recently, there was an article about the discovery of the gene that holds a key for at least some forms of epilepsy. This is absolutely huge because there is so much that dogs and people have in common. It's not only going to help the breeders of breeds that have this as an issue, but it's also going to help humanity. It's really a big deal. But I didn't see anything in the mainstream news about it. You have to sort of be in the in crowd to even know what's going on.
Yeah.
You have to go to the website of either AKC or AKC Canine Health Foundation. And so much of the stuff we do is like that. It's not sexy enough to get picked up by mainstream media. And so we have developed a new platform that is called Breaking Good. And all it's going to deal with is just making sure that the light is shown on all of these wonderful things that are happening from different members of our community, whether it's a farmer or a dog breeder or a scientist, to just get the word out into mainstream media.
Nice. And that's on the NAIA website?
It's actually on both Discover Animals and NAIA, and it will be launched at about the same time as the conference. So look for it in about a month, and we've got it all programmed now. We're just waiting for the right moment to release stuff.
Hey, you guys, we are getting breaking news right here.
Right. It's very good. Very exciting.
It is. It's very exciting. Well, I think that there's lots of interesting and useful information here. So at any rate, thank you, Patty. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time.
Bye-bye.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.